The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, America's streaming royalties, Spotify, and our review of 2015. I'm Andy Malt, the editor of CMU. Over there, you can't see him, it's Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. And this is our very last podcast of 2015.
It is. Christmas is here. Oh, it's not actually here. Well, it depends on you listening to this podcast, because this podcast will be on the website now for the entirety of the festive fortnight.
I like to think that quite a lot of people will be listening over their Christmas lunch.
So, happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas today, as you listen to this.
If you have chosen to listen to this on the 25th of December.
Which, why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't
Even
you?
If you've already listened to it once You'd or have twice.
Well, the thing is, usually with podcasts you generally listen on your own, don't you? Because often you listen to them on a device, you listen to them on the move. That's sort of how podcasts work. But this edition, I think, is put it on the stereo system. Mixcloud have hooked up to Sonos or something. Was that something that happened this week? Anyway, get the podcast onto your stereo system and share it with your entire family over Christmas lunch. I think that's what I'll be doing.
They're going to love Christmas. It. Because even if they're not up to speed with what's going on in the music industry, they don't need to be, because we're going to run through everything that's happened this year.
This is, yeah, it's our review of the year. We're going to talk about some of the big stories that have happened this week as well. Well, two of them.
Yeah, that's enough.
Hasn't been quite that much going on, because we are sort of now winding down for Christmas. But in amongst all of that, we are also going to talk about some of the standout stories and artists and developments that have happened in the music and music business year just gone.
You're damn right. But let's get on to something that's just happened.
Although it is the conclusion of something that has been rumbling on pretty much the entire year.
That is true, yes. So it's sort of a review of the year and a new story.
Yeah.
But it's the conclusion of the US Copyright Royalty Board's review into webcasting royalty rates.
If anybody is sharing this podcast with their family for the first time, that's really going to sell Staying Tuned, isn't it?
Yeah.
What you've just described.
That sounded interesting.
So there was quite a lot of money at stake here. So
money. If you're interested now.
If you're interested in services like Pandora having to pay many more millions to the record industry and record companies and recording artists making many more millions, then that is what this story is ultimately about. So I'm going to very quickly backtrack.
Yep. As you are,
as I'm prone
known
to do. Back to 1996.
Wow.
I think. Can't remember. Anyway, online radio in the US is covered by a compulsory license.
Yep.
Which means if you set up an online radio station in the United States of America, you do not have to go to every single record company and negotiate a separate license to use their recordings. You can get one license through an organization called Sound Exchange. We're not talking about songs here or music publishing or the copyright in the lyrics and the musical score. We're talking about the copyright in sound recordings, so represented by record companies, created by recording artists. And online radio stations in the US can go and get the one license through this organization called Sound Exchange, which represents all the record companies and all the recording artists. And you still have to pay. You have to pay royalties, but you pay set royalties to Sound Exchange, who then pass the money on to the labels and to the artists. It gets split 50-50 between record companies and recording artists. But what rates do you pay?
And who sets them?
And who sets them? So generally speaking, the rates are ultimately set by this thing called the Copyright Royalty Board. So all of this, the compulsory license and the framework out of which came Sound Exchange and the Copyright Royalty Board having the power to set the rates, all came about in the late 1990s, in the early days of the web, when sort of radio was first starting to webcast, as we used to call it. And actually, the Copyright Royalty Board, technically, this is the webcast license. The reason why this is important is that although generally speaking we talk about webcasting, we talk about online radio in respect to the compulsory license and the Sound Exchange, personalized radio services, so Pandora is the biggest, although iHeartRadio is second biggest, and it's not that far behind now from Pandora in terms of users, they qualify for these licenses. And that was a little controversial back in the day, because if you read the statute that came out of Congress that set all of this in motion back in the 90s, you probably wouldn't interpret it to cover a service like Pandora, which, although it's Pandora isn't like Spotify, it's not a full jukebox service. You can't go in at any time and say, play this album, play these tracks, skip, fast forward, rewind. The music that I hear, if I had a Pandora account, is different to the music you hear. So you get a steady stream.
I have better taste.
Because different, not necessarily better.
demonstrably better.
So Pandora will play you a personalised stream of music based on what it knows about you, the artists that you've said you like, and also as you go, you can skip a limited number of tracks. It then remembers what you've skipped, and that informs what music you hear. So that's called personalised radio. It's a form of streaming, but crucially, it is covered by the Sound Exchange licence, the compulsory licence, which is why this was such a big deal. I mean, there have been many copyright royalty board rulings in the past on these rates and also the rates that other services pay, like satellite radio, like Sirius, or services that go through the cable networks. There have been many copyright royalty board rulings over the years, but this is the one that has got a lot of attention,
yeah,
simply because it covers Pandora and iHeartRadio. And in the US streaming market, bearing in mind now that the streaming market is a, if not the significant revenue stream for the record industry, and in the US streaming market, Pandora and iHeartRadio are massive. I mean, so much bigger than the likes of Spotify or Apple Music are over there. I mean, at last count, Pandora was getting close to 80 million active users. So that's not people who signed up 8 years ago and never used the service. Those are active users. And I think iHeartRadio is on about 70 million. So that's half the population, yeah, pretty much, of the US who are using these services. They pay significant sums of money into the record industry as a result of that, although not as much money as the record companies would like.
No, but it's a sort of a thing we've discussed before with services like Spotify when they eventually float on the stock market. Pandora did float on the stock market and then went about trying to get its royalty payments lowered so that there's more profit for its shareholders. Even any profit for its shareholders.
Less losses for its shareholders.
Something, maybe a little bit of something. And that's what Pandora got a lot of bad press, particularly as they went into this review, because they were really lobbying hard to pay less money to the music industry. The music industry was saying, you don't pay us very much already. You can't drop that price.
And it's interesting that a number of services are affected by this. Actually, many services are affected by this ruling, but it has been very much framed as the Pandora versus Sound Exchange issue. There are various reasons for that. Pandora is the biggest of the services, or certainly the streaming services using this license, so there's just the size of it. But as I said, the fact that it's a publicly listed company is also important, and it's a publicly listed company which really only has the one business. I mean, we know this year they've moved into ticketing, and we're going to see them move into on-demand streaming next year, but as it currently stands, they have one revenue stream, which is the personalised radio service. So it means that we have a company listed on Wall Street with a share price that's constantly going up and down. And that makes it easier to see what impact these reviews and subsequent judgments have on the business. And as this ruling has approached, Pandora's share price wobbled, and actually mainly wobbled down.
It's been falling, yeah.
It's been falling. So then there was a whole extra dimension to this, is once the ruling is out, how will Pandora respond? How will the record industry respond? But also, how will Pandora's shareholders respond?
Yes.
So you say that there was some disagreement on the rates. That's unsurprising. But I suppose, crucially, the rate that Pandora are currently paying, Pandora was saying that should come down. Okay, whereas actually the record industry through Sound Exchange was saying, no, far from it going down, it should go quite significantly up. And I suppose there's two things there, which is on Pandora's side, they were saying, well, when the rates were currently paid were agreed, we were much smaller, and now we've reached scale, so you're making more money overall, so we should get a bulk buy discount in essence, because we are using more music. Therefore, although we would like to pay less per stream, because there are many, many more streams overall, you will make more money, even if we're paying less per stream. On the record industry side, they were basically saying, oh, well, the last time we agreed these rates, you were very much a startup. We gave you really preferential treatment because it was early days for your business, and we wanted to allow your business to grow. So you got a special treat last time because it was early days, but now your business is big. You've floated, your founders and your initial shareholders all made a lot of money. You're now a proper media business, and now you should be paying the proper rates. So those were the sort of the arguments on both sides. Pandora wanting it to go down, Sound Exchange wanting it to go up. The Copyright Royalty Board went for somewhere in the middle, although slightly closer to what Pandora wanted than what Sound Exchange wanted.
Yeah, so services Pandora et al. Have been paying 0.14 cents per stream in recent years. Pandora wanted that to be cut to 0.11 cents. Sound Exchange wanted it up to 0.25.
And they went for
0.17.
Yeah. So they're in the middle. So it is a slight increase. And although it's a slight increase per stream, there are so many streams that actually that slight increase is a significant new chunk of money coming into the record industry that gets shared between the labels and the recording artists. So on one level, this is good news for the record industry. They've said they wanted more money. They fought off Pandora trying to cut the royalties. They have more money. As of next year, more money will come in from Pandora, even if streaming numbers remain the same. And actually, they're probably going to go up. So, hurrah for the record industry. Lots more cash. Although, perversely, in response, Pandora were quite pleased with this, and Sound Exchange had a very glum face once this was out.
Yes, well, obviously, that rate has not gone up as much as Sound Exchange wanted, considerably lower than they were pushing for. Also, that increase covers free-to-access streams, so the ad-funded service, which most Pandora users are on.
And all
iHeartRadio users.
There is only a free version.
But there was also a rate change for paid-for streams, so people on Pandora's premium service.
And I suppose it's pretty standard in streaming, when there are directly negotiated deals, as well as when it's done through a compulsory license or through collective licensing, that the cost of delivering paid-for streams, so if the customer is paying a subscription, then the per-stream rate will be higher. Yep. And obviously Spotify is the same. With its direct deals, they pay a lot less on the free version than the paid-for version. Actually, the difference with the Sound Exchange license is not as marked as it is with Spotify on its direct licenses. Although, you know, there is still a difference, although now not as big a difference.
Yeah, if you were a premium user of Pandora, every time you played a song, there would be 0.25 cents going to the music industry. Now it's 0.22. So that's a little bit lower. Now, that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, because like we say, the iHeartRadio has no paid users. Pandora has a very tiny proportion.
I mean, it's less than 5% of their users.
Although
user base.
Pandora really wants to increase the number of premium users. We think that's partly why they bought Ardio recently, because they want to build a better and more attractive premium service.
But there is also the argument that not only do Pandora want to grow their premium user base, the record industry wants Pandora to grow their user base, and indeed they would like all streaming services to put more effort into converting freemium and free users into paid-for users. And so you could say, well, okay, yes, you are earning a bit less on the paid-for revenue stream than you used to, where you're getting a bit more on the free, but now the difference between a free stream and a paid-for stream is much less. And that sort of provides an incentive for Pandora and all of their competitors to put more effort into premium streaming. So although you're going to make less from the premium streams, if there were many more premium streamers, then overall you would be making more money.
Yes.
So perhaps, and often when you do direct deals as a label with a streaming service, you sort of structure the deal to incentivize the streaming service to get as many premium users as possible, so that it is better for the streaming service if they have both a free version and a premium version. So like Spotify, you set up the deal so it's in the streaming service's interest to try and convert people to premium, because premium always brings in more money, so everybody ultimately wants as many people as possible on premium. So you could say, well, actually, in some ways, that is also good for the record industry. Yes, okay, they're going to bring in a little bit less in the short term, but if it motivates Pandora to convert more people into paying users. Now, it may be that that's just an impossible task, but if they could, then everybody wins. But anyway, here am I, desperately trying to find some silver linings in all of this for the record industry.
Sound Exchange didn't find any.
they weren't attempting to put a positive spin on this.
They said it was deeply disappointing and that they're reviewing their options, which may mean that they will appeal.
Yes, they have an option to appeal. I mean, there's two more stages this can go through, although it's been very much spun as a done deal, and Pandora have been very much talking about it as a done deal, saying we've got the security now of knowing our rates for the next 5 years, and that's good for our shareholders. First of all, it has to go to the Register of Copyright, who is a person in the American government who oversees copyright stuff. She's only going to look at it from a legal process perspective. It's not that she can disagree with the ruling. It's the Copyright Royalty Board to decide. But she can say, oh, you didn't go through the appropriate processes to reach it. So that's probably a rubber stamping exercise, but it does still have to go to her. Plus, any of the stakeholders could appeal. So Sound Exchange could appeal this, or they could just take it on the chin and try and you know, they'll get in more money anyway through the free stuff, and perhaps they can persuade services to do more premium stuff, and that also will bring in more money.
Yes. As you say, and this ruling has had more significance and attention placed on it than most. But in many ways, this ruling might actually end up being less significant than previous ones that we've paid no attention to at all.
Yes, despite all the hype and the coverage. And I mean, OK, over here in the UK, it was just people like us and our competitors who were hyping this up. But in the US, actually, it was a big news story across the business press.
Yeah, but Pandora has indicated in its response to the ruling that it's going to start doing more direct deals with music rights companies, and therefore won't be going through Sound Exchange's kind of set royalty rates anyway.
Yes, so we've seen that the last 18 months. So Pandora originally relied entirely on Sound Exchange for the sound recording rights and entirely on BMI and ASCAP to get cover the song copyrights. And although technically speaking, there isn't a compulsory license on that side, for technical reasons, in reality, there is. So Pandora originally did everything through the collective licensing system. But then what we've seen in the last 18 months is it's starting to move over to having direct relationships with rights owners, because the way these compulsory licenses work in the US is it's a one-way obligation. So the labels are obliged to license through Sound Exchange. The publishers are obliged to license through BMI and ASCAP. But the services can do whatever they like. They don't have to go through the societies. They can go and do direct deals. We've seen quite a few of those on the publishing side, and three of them in the last month.
Yeah.
But of course, they did the deal with Merlin, whenever that was. It was some time ago now. So they have started to do direct deals on the recording side too. And you mentioned that was something they said in their statement afterwards. We think this is good. Obviously, it's a higher rate than we wanted, but it was within the margins we were expecting. We can make this work. But then they said, anyway, we're going to go down the direct dealing route. And reasons for that is mainly because of Pandora's ambitions. We know that Pandora have new ambitions to go global, which was an original ambition, and they sort of put that on hold
when they realised that America's weird copyright system doesn't
apply
anywhere else.
We know they want to move into on-demand. You mentioned the RDO acquisition as well. And yeah, outside of the US, they can't rely on a Sound Exchange licence. And in the US, if they're going to move into Spotify territory, they can't rely on a Sound Exchange licence either. So for all of those ambitions, they're going to probably have to start doing deals with Sony and Universal and Warner. They might have to pay more through those deals, but they'll get kickbacks on the on-demand and on the global stuff, etc. So it may well be, I mean, this ruling lasts for 5 years. It's locked to inflation. So the rates that we told you could go up each year, depending on what happens with inflation. But anyway, it could be that in those 5 years, the Sound Exchange license becomes irrelevant. It would still be relevant to lots of sort of more conventional online radio services and smaller services, but it might be that for the big guys like Pandora and even iHeart, I mean, they've not been as proactive in the direct licensing sphere, although they have dabbled in that themselves. It could be that the Sound Exchange license becomes utterly irrelevant. And in 5 years' time, when this review will happen again, for the big services that really dominate in digital, we won't even be talking about it. But we'll see.
Okay, enough of looking at the present and the future. Let's look back to the past with part one of our review of the year.
So the recent past.
Jingle just here.
Oh, yeah. Have you made a jingle? Or are you assuming that Matt's made a jingle?
Sure, I'm sure Matt's made a jingle.
I'm sure there is a very exciting review of the year type jingle.
Yeah.
There you go, that could be it.
Blurred Lines, that happened this year.
The Blurred Lines
case.
Not
the song, that's old.
Yes, that was a number of years ago.
But the court case surrounding it.
And I think if I had to pick one thing that we've written about this year to be my favourite thing, I think the Blurred Lines case was my favourite thing.
It was very entertaining. It was, I mean, this is whenever we say this won't make it to court, but we're really looking forward to it if it does. Blurred Lines shows why we always say that, because these things almost never get to court. They almost always settle out of court, but when they do get to court, they're so good.
And this was a very good trial. So, I mean, we'd already had the depositions, because I think those were released late last year. So we'd already had the comedy depositions where Robin Thicke admitted that he hadn't really had any involvement.
Yeah. Although we latterly got more of those depositions, and they were still very funny.
Because he'd been off his head at the time, and then we had Pharrell just talking utter nonsense, and responding to everything with a cliche, but they weren't even cliches, because
random words.
They didn't make sense. And of course, Robin Thicke appeared in court. He got his piano out.
Did a turn.
He did a little turn. Not many court cases this year had Robin Thicke on the piano.
No.
So
not enough.
So it was an entertaining case. And also, I mean, actually, ultimately, I think it was the wrong ruling. Obviously, it was that Thicke and Pharrell were accused of ripping off Marvin Gaye track on Blurred Lines, and therefore it was copyright infringement. And there was various copyright complications around the case, which we won't go into. I'm still not convinced that it was the right ruling. It was a jury trial, and the minute you involve juries in these things, it all goes a bit weird.
Never let the public vote for things.
Massive damages awarded, of course. I mean, the appeal thing is still going through the motions. There may as yet be an appeal on this next year. So I'm personally not convinced it was the right ruling, although I'm not likewise convinced. When the ruling was made, there were plenty of people, including Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams people, saying this sets a dangerous precedent and songwriting will stop. And I don't buy any of that. But I'm not convinced it was the right ruling. Although, having said that, I still think it's very funny. And I have lots of issues with the song, which obviously, if you come and see Chris Cook's free speech when I perform it again in the new year in London.
Is that a thing that's actually going to happen?
I will explain why I have problems with the song. And so it amuses me greatly that Pharrell lost all that money over it. So there you go. So I think that was my standout. Staying with copyright, I think the other thing, I'm not going to talk too much about copyright, because as you know, I could talk about copyright all the way through to New Year, if you want to.
And we haven't got time.
And other than obviously the Dissecting the Digital Dollar Report, which was, I think, the standout moment of the music copyright year. Making available, I think the developments on the making available right, which we've talked about before on the podcast, there was two things there that were interesting, because this is the one artist-focused area of copyright law that is being reviewed at the moment. If we get clarification on the so-called making available right, which is one of the sort of the components of copyright, the making available right came out in the 1990s. It has been very much written to the label's favour, and there's a real movement amongst artists saying, you know, hang on a second, this basic concept was introduced in the 90s. We all weren't watching. The labels had it implemented into law at a national level to their favour. It's time to review it, because if we can just get the making available right changed, this is one way that artists could get a bigger cut of particularly digital income. It's all about digital downloads and streams. And the two big developments in making available was there was a couple of test cases in Scandinavia around making available where the artists won. And just a week ago, the European Union confirmed that a review of the making available right was on its agenda for copyright reform in the next 12 months. And I think that's a massive achievement, because this is not something the labels particularly want to be up for debate. They're quite happy with the way it is. So the labels don't really want it in court. They certainly don't want it being discussed in political circles. And both those things happened this year. And I think we could see more movement on this next year.
Yeah. And I mean, just generally in 2015, I think we've seen artists become far more vocal and engaged in the debates around how their music is used, what they get paid for, how they get paid for it, and how much they get paid.
And I would give kudos to the Featured Artist Coalition for this, because also not only are artists talking about it more, and of course songwriters also have been talking about it a lot
talking about it in an informed manner, rather than just kind of firing off an angry... Well, lots of people are still firing off angry tweets about their payments from Spotify. But I think an increasing number of artists are saying, I'm not getting paid enough from Spotify, and I want to know why.
And behind the scenes, the FAC in the UK and the IAO, International Artist Organization, which came about this year, which is similar organizations around the world getting together, they have been doing a lot of lobbying on the quiet in Brussels. And I think that is why making available is on the agenda there. If it hadn't been for the FAC and their counterparts elsewhere in Europe, that wouldn't have happened. And, you know, for someone who's written about the music industry for over 15 years, I don't remember a time when the artist community was, A, this engaged, but B, actually proactively doing things, actually engaging in the political circle, rather than just being wheeled in by the labels or the publishers when it suited them at a latter stage in the political debate, actually trying to set the political agenda. And I think that is quite exciting.
It is. Let's just pause for a quick plug. I just wrote an article for How We Get to Next about what it will be like forming a band in 2040. And in it, I suggested that with the artists engaged so much at the moment, there's a real opportunity for the music industry in 25 years' time to be a lot more artist-led. So artists really need to keep the momentum up with this, because they could really change things for the better if they keep going and pushing hard.
So let's keep an eye on this. And if you are an artist, join the FAC. I'm not paid to say, I really am not paid to say that, but I think personally they're doing really good stuff, and you should throw your weight behind it, because the more artists who support it, the more success those organisations will have. Talking of people being quite vocal this year.
Yep, the grassroots live community.
They've been quite vocal. They started last year, actually.
Yes.
They had that meeting, didn't they? The first Venues Day.
I mean, it's taken off very quickly.
And all the sort of the people who run small venues or who promote gigs with predominantly new artists in those small venues, who they've come together in the past, but never quite in this organised way.
Yeah.
They really are capitalising on this. And perhaps it's because there's more of an emergency. It's a hard time to be putting on grassroots gigs in small venues. So perhaps there's an element of emergency that's helping them.
I think that was what kind of got people to become so proactive so quickly, because everyone's really struggling.
And there's various issues around this. So they've been talking about licensing issues. They've been talking about funding issues. They obviously ticket touting, secondary ticketing has been very much back on the agenda this year for various reasons.
Currently being reviewed by the government, as we've discussed already.
And I think the grassroots live industry have been much more vocal on that issue this time. And they've got artists to be much more vocal on this issue this time than in past I mean, this issue keeps coming back on the agenda every 2 or 3 years, but you feel that the promoters and the artists are being much more, again, much more active on this issue.
Well, just
this
week, I mean, not at all grassroots, but we've seen Mumford & Sons not only put out a very stern statement about their views on secondary ticketing, but said, we've gone into the Department of Culture, Media and Sport and we've made them extend the deadline on public consultation on this secondary ticketing review, which is, I mean, that's always being proactive in a way I don't think I've ever seen before.
And I think the other element to this is the so-called Music Cities movement is growing, and obviously the IFPI and Music Canada put out their report earlier this year, which I think was very widely read. Martin Elbin, the founder of The Great Escape, spoke about this at The Great Escape, and indeed he had teamed up with Shane Shapiro to launch the Music Cities conference that happens just alongside The Great Escape in Brighton in May. They also did one quite recently in Washington, coming back to Brighton next May. And I think, again, that is equipping the live music community, which is often quite disparate, to be able to go to their local authorities and say, we play a really important role, not just in the culture of this city, but the economy of this city. Because if you have a vibrant music community, it often results in a vibrant business community, which then attracts startups and entrepreneurs, and a whole load of stuff can be built around that. And I think that the power of this idea of, I'm not sure every city can be a music city, but this ambition of turning your regional cities into music cities and the role little venues have in that is sort of giving the grassroots music community more weight. So it doesn't just come across as them constantly moaning, that they actually have a better argument to take to the people who can help them with licensing issues and funding issues and so on. I mentioned The Great Escape there with Martin talking about music cities at last year's Great Escape. Something we're going to talk about at next year's Great Escape. So I am doing a little bit of forward-looking here, which in the intro you said wasn't allowed.
We weren't. All right, get it over with.
But another marked thing this year has been data transparency and blockchain. That is to say, everyone banging on about data, transparency and the blockchain. And actually, at this year's Great Escape, 2015, the transparency was the most used word across the 3 days.
Yeah.
And labels in particular saying we need to be more transparent. Publishers, collecting societies, we need to be more transparent. And artists and managers have been saying that for a long time now. But everyone is now saying we need to be more transparent as to how money comes in from the digital services, what happens to that money, what fees are being charged, what commissions are being taken. We need to be much more transparent about that. And that's become a real buzzword. And we've seen various people dabbling with having better copyright data. And people have been talking about using the blockchain as the, sort of the Uber place to store this data and process this money. So that has been very interesting. However, what I think will be interesting next year, and this is what we'll be looking at The Great Escape in 2016, is there's been a lot of talk about transparency this year and some vague commitments about transparency this year. I'm not aware of any transparency really having happened this year, other than the people who were transparent already. So I think that is, well, what does it even mean by transparency? And what can we realistically expect labels and publishers and collecting societies and digital services to be more transparent about? So a lot of talk about that this year. Will anything come of it next year? Well, we'll see, but something will come of it at The Great Escape because it's one of our strands. So come along in May.
Yes, and there ends part one of our review of the year. Join us again in about 10 minutes when we'll get to part two. Okay, back to this week's news. A bit more digital music, bit of radio, sort of covering an area we've talked about in the first story. But this is Radio 1 and One Extra's head of music, George Ergatoudis, has announced that he is leaving and going to Spotify.
Yeah, so a bit of UK-focused streaming news this week. And I suppose, again, there is an element of this has been a trend this year.
Yeah.
And I've been saying for a number of years, not that I'm just coming here today to say, ha-ha, it's me being proven right. But someone else was doing that. I think it was Mark Mulligan was doing that earlier this week. Ah, look at my blog from 2 years ago. I was proven right, so I'm going to do it myself. Although I'm not sure I've got a blog I can link you to. You'll just have to take my word for it.
It's a website. If you do some, when the search on our website is terrible, you won't find anything. But
I'm sure it's there somewhere.
Yeah. You might be lucky.
Is that as streaming goes more mainstream, or as Daniel Ek said earlier this year, as Spotify starts mainstreaming, these services need to have a better understanding of what mainstream music fans listen to, what they are interested in. All the services have done a lot in discovery this year. Well, they've been talking about discovery for a number of years, haven't they? Our discovery services are better than your discovery services. How we help people navigate this ridiculously large catalogue of content that every streaming service, or certainly every Spotify-style streaming service, offers. you need to get better at helping the casual consumer navigate that content. So the early adopters were all music geeks. For them, it's a turn on going in there and sort of basically doing the digital equivalent of going into a record shop and flicking through every box of records and trying to discover that. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, I don't know what that is. I'll listen to it. For the early adopters, that is exciting. For mainstream consumers, they just want to press a button and have great music play. And so the thing I have said for a number of years is, well, the people who understand what more mainstream music fans like and how discovery works with more mainstream music fans, how you have to get this balance of giving them what they already like and then slowly drip feeding new content, but not a load of new content, otherwise you'll lose them. The people who understand that are radio people, because that is what radio programming is about. And while we might not enjoy listening to certain radio stations because they play the same 37 tracks on a loop for weeks on end, and so for you, I know you would hate that.
Yes.
I think a lot of people listening to this podcast, that's sort of their idea of hell.
Yep.
That's why they've chosen to listen to us
over the Christmas dinner. No music at all.
Rather than putting on the magic. Well, I'm sure we're playing some great Christmas tracks today if you are listening to this on Christmas Day. Anyway, radio people, that is what they are good at. I'm not saying they're perfect at it, but radio people have a better understanding of that. And so therefore, why aren't the streaming services tapping radio people? Or indeed, why aren't radio people launching streaming services? Obviously, in the US, iHeartRadio. iHeart is the biggest AM/FM radio station.
And Radio 1 has ambitions in that domain.
As does Global Radio, who own Capital and Heart, etc. But that, until very recently, you had the streaming services over here, Spotify, Deezer, Audio, etc. You had radio stations over here. And the two didn't talk. And I suppose what we have seen this year, I mean, mainly with BBC talent and mainly Radio 1 talent, but that we have started to see the streaming services tap radio talent to help them with the curation and developing the discovery tools for more mainstream users. And originally, we saw that with Apple. Of course, Zane Lowe was the big grab, but with him...
various other people. Yeah.
Yes, various behind-the-scenes people, producers, people who understand the programming side of new music on Radio 1 were nabbed by Apple. So Apple did it earlier this year ahead of the launch of Beats 1 and Apple Music. And so this is interesting. Well, actually, Vivo had... they recruited an ex-BBC executive to run, and then he then brought in Andy Parfit, who is an ex-Radio 1 boss, to consult on programming. So Vivo have done it as well, and now Spotify have brought in George. In some ways, well, obviously, Zane Lowe. I mean, that was front page news when Zane went to Apple. But I would say after Zane, and maybe even more so than Zane, within the music industry, George is probably the highest profile music person.
Yeah.
At the BBC and almost in radio within the UK music industry for certain. So aside from the skills that he brings to the table, it's quite a headline-grabbing hire within the music industry.
Yes, he's going to be head of content programming for the UK. So he's still obviously very much UK-focused. He's not like Zane, not going off to the US and running things from there. There is, I think, there's always already an international head of content programming, but he's very much focused on the UK. And that's, I mean, that sort of shows Spotify's intentions, I think. Like, obviously, it's one thing to, well, you know, Apple created the first global radio station, as if that's a thing that someone wants. Actually, you want to create things that work for different places, because what people like on the radio in, I don't know, anywhere other than the UK, somewhere in Europe, France, is not going to be the same as what, you know, a UK audience wants. And so having dedicated people in each, I don't think they probably have one in every country, but in kind of key territories where they're really kind of dominant, like the UK, like the US, that's an important thing to be doing.
It'll be interesting to know exactly what that job's going to entail. I think there are two potential sides to it. First of all, obviously, we've talked about on the podcast, we've talked about a lot at The Great Escape this year. Playlisting is becoming really important within the streaming services, and particularly within Spotify. That's how a lot of people now navigate. They find the playlists that are familiar to them, they sign up. That's how new music gets pushed. We've seen record companies and artist managers now pitching to the people who control the playlists on Spotify. And although anyone can have a Spotify playlist, and labels have playlists, and media have playlists, and individuals have playlists, actually, pretty much across the board, the most subscribed to playlists on Spotify are owned by Spotify, and they are programmed by people within Spotify. They're quite secretive about, whereas Deezer have always been very upfront about who is doing the playlisting. Yeah. Spotify have been a little more secretive about that, but one would imagine that George is going to have quite a significant role in that, given that that is what he did at Radio 1. So it may be a sign that they're more formalising the playlisting process of the Spotify-owned playlist, and that they may be more upfront about who it is that you're pitching to. The other thing is, obviously, earlier in the year, when Spotify tried to preempt Apple Music by announcing a big list of stuff they were going to do, just on the off chance that Apple was going to do any of those things, so they could be there first, they talked about original content.
Yeah, well, they talked about lots of things that they have really, like, not yet launched. There was that massive press conference in May, and we have seen almost none of what they announced. The Spotify Running, that launched pretty much straight away. But there was all, they were going to be pulling in podcasts, they were going to have original programming, they were going to have news, they were going to have a whole new feed that would, you could start it playing at any time of day and it would know what you wanted to listen to and it would play it to you and it would play you...
Based on where you were.
Based on where you were, what you were doing,
what time it was like.
It would play you the news if it thought you wanted the news and it would play you music and different music depending on the time of day and what you were doing. None of that's happened. It just seemed like, it now seems like... just Daniel Ek stood up and just said some things.
Well, basically, yeah. Well, Apple might say this, so let's get in first.
They've just announced Spotify Party, which was not part of that announcement, which is a, basically like kind of... I mean, it is kind of original programming. It's basically pre-mixed playlists by people like Diplo, who is the big celeb they've pulled out for the launch of that. But that wasn't part of their announcement.
And actually, the most significant thing they've introduced this year was the Discover Weekly playlist, which, despite you slagging it off on the podcast, I mean, A, you've come round to as actually being quite good.
Every few weeks I get one that is completely unlistenable, but usually it's very good.
And it's certainly, within the industry, it seems to have been very popular. And so that's probably the most significant thing they've done this year. And that wasn't part of their big announcement.
So it will be interesting to see, like you say, what Georgia Katusis does. I mean, I suppose one bit of original content they did was the Spotify in residence thing, where they had basically playlists with pre-recorded radio show style links from various people,
which, as we said, actually had been sort of informally within Spotify. Billy Bragg has done it for a long time, but they sort of formalised that and made it a thing.
But I'm not sure it's really taken off.
No, I think beyond the press release, I've heard no no one mention it. Back at Radio 1, the search is on for a new head of music. Will they recruit internally? Will they nab somebody else? And I think the BBC, obviously, they've lost presenters and producers to Apple. They've now lost their Radio 1 head of music to Spotify. But they seem to put a positive spin on it, because I think they're almost using this. Obviously, the BBC is in very much in defence mode at the moment because the government is reviewing it, the licence review, all of that. And so they sort of see it as being, this is another example of the BBC training people up and then feeding the wider media and new media with the talent that, without the BBC and the unique way the BBC is funded, that talent wouldn't be there. And they'd said that earlier in the year when Apple nabbed all those people. And the statement that the BBC put out, I think it was Spotify's press release, had a Radio 1 statement in it, didn't it? So in Radio 1, we're in essence saying, we're not hugely pissed off about this right from the start, and this is another example of us feeding the talent of the future. So if everyone is nabbing Radio 1's talent to go and do Apple and Spotify and all the other digital stuff, where can Radio 1 get their talent from?
Well, I think
Vice,
it'll be interesting.
Noisy, that's maybe, where all the interesting stuff's happening. SBTV.
I think it will be interesting because, obviously, the one thing Radio 1 has been struggling with in recent years is hitting its remit, which is 15 to 25 year olds, and their demographic is skewed slightly older, more towards 30. And it'd be interesting to see if they hire someone who's worked more in the kind of youth domain,
which these days is the YouTube domain.
Yes.
So perhaps they'll be looking for a YouTuber, or perhaps they're headhunting across the schoolyards of Britain to try and find the 17-year-old who truly understands what music teenagers want to listen to. Although the 17-year-old might say, yeah, just give up on reading. That's probably not what they want. Anyway, big shift. He's not actually there till January, is he?
So March.
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 So he's got another couple of months at Radio 1. So he could still completely drive that radio station into the ground if he wanted to in those 2 months. And then he'll go at Spotify. So who will Radio 1 recruit in his place? And will we see an impact on both the playlist that we listen, the way playlists are pitched to, or original programming on Spotify as a result of this recruitment?
Now, as promised, back in the mists of time. Who can even remember when it was? It's part two of our review of the year. So what's next?
Let's carry on talking about streaming very quickly.
Sure, why not?
We're talking about Spotify, developments at Spotify this year. And obviously, streaming has been a massive talking point within the music industry. The trend that we saw in 2014 was CDs continuing to slowly decline, downloads plummeting, streaming booming. And that's basically the trend that we've seen pretty much across the record industry in most countries, certainly here in the UK this year. Within the streaming domain, we've had quite a few closures and one big arrival.
Yes.
In that we lost Ardio, we lost Blinkbox, we lost Rock.
Ardio's still going till the 22nd.
Ardio is still going for another...
But if you listen to this on Christmas Day, Ardio is gone.
It's gone.
Although, because I had an Ardio account, I got the email through saying, oh, we're closing on the 22nd of December. But it was very much like, we're closing for now.
It's yes.
Like, see you, bye.
You went bankrupt. And Sony Entertainment Network went offline too. So lots of services, and predominantly services that were basically going with the Spotify model have gone. Apple Music obviously is the big arrival, and I think Mark Mulligan was saying he reckons that they'll have 8 million subscribers, paying subscribers, so ignoring free trialers, by the end of the year. He predicts that will at least double next year. I didn't actually read his report, so I don't know what he was basing that on, but that was what Mark Mulligan was saying. And certainly, you know, 8 million sounds about right from what we're hearing elsewhere from both the labels and the distributors. So Apple Music, second biggest after Spotify. So to become second biggest in 6 months is an immense achievement. Although, are these 800 million iTunes subscribers that were going to be turned on to streaming?
Yeah, you would expect Apple's streaming service to grow quickly because it's Apple.
But I would say, I think the most interesting things to happen in streaming this year are Amazon Prime Music, which actually launched last year in the US but arrived in the UK this year and has been growing. Universal finally came on board with the music element of Amazon Prime. And YouTube's move into subscription, the abandonment of Music Key and the setting up of YouTube Red, albeit at the moment only in the US, that should arrive here in the UK next year. And actually, I think both of those are the more interesting developments in streaming, because Apple Music is just Spotify with Apple's logos and a less good user experience and a silly radio station on the side. So Apple Music is very much competing in the same space as Spotify. And as we have said so many times, and we're not the only people saying this, there's a lot of consensus on this across the record industry. $120, £120 a year for recorded music is way too much for most people who don't want an all-you-can-eat experience of the Spotify style. The middle market is where the most important developments are going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. The people who might spend £2 or £3 a month on music, or where you could bundle it in with a cheap mobile package or a cheap messaging app or a cheap ISP.
Yeah, so these two are particularly interesting because obviously Amazon Prime Music is something you get if you are an Amazon Prime member, so you're signing up for free delivery on their retail service. You also get the Amazon Prime video streaming service and an ebook thing, I think.
Yes.
I have a membership. I have no idea about this ebook thing other than the fact that you've mentioned it. And then the music service, which I've used occasionally to look things up. A prime bit of trolling from that this year, which is they don't have the Adele album, and if you search for Adele, it says, would you like to listen to Duffy?
And did you?
No.
Well, you want to listen to Adele, so why would you want to listen to Duffy?
And obviously YouTube Red is part of a wider subscription service to the whole of YouTube, so it's sort of just sneaking it in the back.
No, and I think the two things there is obviously Amazon Prime. It means it's cheaper because you're getting a lot more stuff. Actually, in the UK, Amazon Prime's cheaper anyway.
Yeah.
Plus, you're getting all the... Even if Amazon Prime went up to £120 tomorrow, you're getting so much more. So overall, it's a lot cheaper. And for mainstream, we need to offer a more limited service. Amazon Prime is a more limited service. You don't get anywhere near the catalogue of Spotify. You don't get the brand new releases.
But they've really talked that up as a selling point.
But it's a more mainstream product, which is a lot cheaper. And then YouTube Red, again, this bundling. Actually, in the music industry, we forget most consumers don't want music in isolation. And even if you buy the conspiracy theory that YouTube never really had intentions of putting Music Key live, and it was sort of a conspiracy theory to shut up the labels for a few months. But what YouTube say is when they piloted Music Key for a whole year, the feedback that they were getting, they piloted it with YouTube users who used a lot of music, who consumed a lot of music on YouTube. So they picked people on YouTube who they knew were music fans, and the feedback they kept getting back from those people was, why is this just music? Why would we want a YouTube service that was just music? That's insane. And I think that's the thing to remember, is casual consumers want music in amongst everything else. I'm not saying YouTube Red's going to work. I think that still the jury is very much out as to whether or not YouTube can persuade people to stop paying for its content. But if it does work, then that will be hugely significant. So I think for me, in a year with lots of stories going on in the streaming space, Amazon Prime and YouTube Red, I mean, it's a shame that those are two of the biggest companies in the world who could end up sewing up this market instead of quirky little startups. But those are the ones to watch for me next year.
Yes, as we've alluded to a couple of times already, YouTubers, big burgeoning area of the media industry or future media industry.
And I think that's been happening for a couple of years now, but I think this was the year where it became really apparent just how significant these big YouTubers are. And the fact this whole new industry, there's a brand new entertainment industry evolving around them, which is sort of a mashup of the TV industry because it's video content, but the music industry because unlike TV, it's very much based around individuals rather than program formats. And I think the whole YouTuber phenomenon is fascinating. It's another thing we're going to do a whole day on at The Great Escape in May. Also, there's a Music 4.5 event on this happening in the new year where I'm going to be hosting that as well. So I think YouTubers and the whole new industry that's building around YouTubers is so interesting. So interesting there ain't time to talk about it now because we'd have to spend a lot more time talking about it. But it's something we will definitely be coming back to again next year, even though you could say it's very much on the edge of the conventional music industry because the YouTubers who are gaining, there are some artists doing interesting stuff on YouTube, although the really big YouTubers, they certainly aren't musicians, and actually a lot of them aren't even talking about music. So it's a very interesting era nonetheless.
Talking of the artists, there's been a lot of artist stuff. There's all these musicians around
who keep releasing records.
We have mentioned a few times already in this podcast, but you know, not more in a business sense. It's worth noting that
this was a year when artists released records.
They also released music and toured and did all kinds of creative things as well as talking about the business. I think that's worth noting. I think it's been a very strong year for music this year. I think one of my favourite things, not necessarily creatively, but one of my favourite things with artists this year had been the return of Justin Bieber.
Yes, less his music, more his interviews is what you've enjoyed this year.
Because Justin Bieber, having been the bad boy of pop music for several years, which had become quite tedious, he sort of reinvented himself as Jesus, basically.
And, at one point, almost saying as much.
Yeah.
Or certainly comparing
and
himself.
He, as if we've discussed at length previously, one of his interviews where he said some of the most ridiculous things. But Justin Bieber's turnaround has been very entertaining to write about this year. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Almost seemingly inspired by Pharrell when it comes to coming up with responses to questions. Not perhaps not quite as nonsensical as Pharrell in deposition mode, but a lot of slightly bizarre statements. So providing you have all managed to block those paparazzi photos of him out of your brain, because that might have disturbed you at some point this year. But forgetting that, what came out of his mouth when he wasn't singing was very interesting.
Although he's been very successful as a singer as well.
Yes.
But he is not one of the musicians I want to talk about musically now. Because, as I say, I think it's been a very, very good year for music. There's been lots of really great releases.
And not just Adele. For about a week, you might have thought there was just Adele. Although, I said that, there was that week, because obviously you had the Bieber album, which was big. You had One Direction's final album, and although One Direction peaked a couple of years ago, I mean, they're still selling good numbers. Coldplay's album came out a couple of weeks later. That seems to be doing well. So we've had a number of big releases. The Rihanna album never came out, although it could still come out.
Could still, but
it might be out by the time
it may or may not be
out.
Finished.
So we didn't have Rhapsody, although Taylor Swift's album was last year. Someone was pointing out she's not eligible for Best International Female in the Brits this year, even though she's had a really big year. Yeah. But because her album was just out of the window, because her album came out in, I think, October, was it, last year? But even though she's not had an album out this year, another big successful year for Taylor Swift, mainly by shouting at Apple and then going into business with Apple. So those are some of the sort of the big pop stars and the bigger name acts who have all been active this year and had some success. But talk us through the five artists that got you most excited this year, of which none of them I've just mentioned.
No, because, yes, we've got, if you've been reading the CMU Approve column this week, we've been running through our five favourite artists of the year, using that to look backward rather than forward as the column normally does. But I think this year, it was a hard list to pick because there's been a lot of really, really exciting music this year.
And there should have been 10, but you got your dates mixed up and we ended
up... Did you have to tell people that there was an administrative error in the CMU Approve column?
And anyway, we ended up doing five there. But it's good. Focus. Concise.
Yes. If you want to know more, there's a whole. I've created a whole playlist on Spotify featuring almost all the tracks we approved this year. It is 11 hours of pure gold that you can listen to for the rest of Christmas Day.
Fully
when
approved.
You've finished listening to this podcast. So, number one on our list.
This is not all 11 hours. This is the five.
No, I'm
going to
run through
five.
The five we've written about this week. Who's Susanna Sundfør, who released her fifth album at the beginning of the year, which is a great album. I have listened to it a lot.
This was the
year.
One you declared as album of the year.
Yeah, because I actually got hold of it in like November last year or October. Anyway, I'd been listening to it quite a lot already, and it's.
It was your album of 2015
it was my
before
album
2015.
Yes, and I stand by that because it's really, really good. She is an incredible artist, one who's not afraid to suddenly change her sound. There was an interview that she did with The Guardian where she was talking about how, like, as much as like it's a musically complex album, one of the hardest things in making it, she found, was actually creating good pop songs, and she was really studying the kind of the mechanics of a good pop song, and that was like kind of making that work was one of the hardest things, although something she succeeded at.
Number two in your approved artists of 2015.
Holly Herndon, who is someone we've written about a few times in recent years. She released her latest album, her first album for 4AD, and that is also, I mean, to say it was a shift towards pop would be a lie. But she's always been very experimental, and Platform, her latest album, is far more cohesive and kind of listenable.
Accessible.
Accessible, that's the word I'm looking for.
Is the word we use
really
in these
circumstances. I saw her live this year. That was very good live. I think she was aiming to make kind of experimental music that would work in a club setting. And while I don't think you're going to be hearing it on a Friday and Saturday night in a nightclub, it did work in a club where I was seeing her live with an audience of people who wanted to see her live.
In her club.
Yes. It worked.
It worked.
It was good. But I think whereas a lot of her stuff previously has been quite... Oh, meandering's not fair. But it wasn't the most easy listen in the past.
Approved of the year number three, and I said you'd rejected all those really big artists that I listed just before we started going through this list who've had big albums and successes this year. Although your next approved of the year you might not think of as being in the list with Adele and Bieber and One Direction and Coldplay, although...
But he really was.
In terms of, certainly on the streaming platforms, the streams his music was getting, he was well up there with the biggest artists of the year.
Yeah, Kendrick Lamar. I think you could not have a list of artists who have been significant in 2015 without Kendrick Lamar on it, because he's been incredibly significant this year. And like you say, you know, the week his album was, well, there's a dispute over whether his album was rush released because it was leaked or Interscope accidentally released it early.
I like the latter explanation.
I prefer that one. But there was such a buzz around the album, it appeared on Spotify, and he broke the record for highest number of streams in a single day with that album. Obviously, Bieber, One Direction and Adele have gone on to take that crown from him, but that still puts him in that list. And it's, you know, musically, again, I wouldn't, this is, it's not an easy listen of an album, but it's a very engaging listen. It's one that kind of, I think, becomes easier over time. It's an album you've got to listen to a lot of times because it's quite dense, quite complex. It covers a lot of different themes, both personal to him and kind of in a wider context of Black America at the moment. Obviously, that's been a big thing in the news, kind of the police attitudes to and deaths of people at the hands of police in America. So it's a very significant album, which I felt had to be on this list.
Number two,
you already said number two.
Did I?
You're working down now.
Oh, now I'm counting down.
This list
down.
Isn't ordered, so they could be two number twos.
Okay, let's call it number 17.
Okay, what? Number 17 is Everything, who...
Which is surprising, because for a band that were very buzzy a couple of years ago, you weren't quite so into the buzz when they were first around as perhaps other people were.
No, well, I think like early, their first single, we did write about them around their first singles, and then just never really got into either of their first two albums. Like, I listened to them and thought, that's quite nice, but I never went back to them particularly, beyond maybe like a second or third listen. Whereas the thing I think they've been trying to achieve all this time, they really hit it with their latest album, Get to Heaven. It's a really, really good album. Again, I feel like there's a bit of a theme running through this. And in fact...
Accessible experimental.
Accessible experimental. That is definitely looking at what's coming up. It's experimental, but yeah, very accessible. It's very pop. It's all engaging. It was very hard. I said in the article I wrote, it's very hard to pick a favourite track off it because all of the tracks are incredibly strong, incredibly good. And yeah, they've done very well, and I hope the trend continues upwards with their music.
Finally and quickly, because I now want to go and listen to this 11-hour playlist that you've set up. So tell us about your final Artist of the Year. Although this isn't number one, so this isn't the Artist of the Year, but it's definitely one of the Artists of the Year.
Grimes, who is both experimental and accessible. When did she sign to Rock Nation for management? That seemed like a slightly odd deal at the time. But in the context of her new music, I think makes more sense. She's definitely... I mean, she was already kind of going for the experimental, accessible slant, particularly with her previous album. This one really, I think whereas previously she'd been very much an independent artist recording in her bedroom, basically. Another 4AD artist, in fact. And she has now, with the backing of Rock Nation, has now got the resources to kind of go into the studio to hire more musicians to kind of create this larger thing.
Where someone where almost the lo-fi-ness of the early stuff was the attraction. So yeah. When money's on the table, you're like, oh, is this going to screw it up? But yeah. She spent that money well.
Yeah, I think the big fear was that throwing money at someone like Grimes was going to ruin it. But her album Art Angels is really good. Another one that I've come back to a lot. And for all of these albums are albums that I have listened to a lot this year.
Another accessimental. That's what I'm calling this.
Is that
now.
What we're calling?
Yeah, accessible but experimental. Some good accessimental approved stuff there. So go on to the website /approved, and at the top there you will find the link to the Of the Year playlist, 11 hours listen to thing. Yeah, I don't really build that very well,
have
I?
You've not really.
Go on the website, read more, listen more.
Yes, so /approved, or you can go to the podcast notes. You'll find links to everything we've talked about in there. But now we have run out of time, so I better do the last outro of the year.
Except to say this is the last podcast until January now. We're not going to be in here on Christmas Day.
We're not.
You're listening to this on Christmas Day.
You're listening to this on Christmas Day, as
so
we know.
So, no podcast till January. See Me Daily also takes 2 weeks off, although if any big stories break over the Christmas period, we will be reporting them online. So follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or just keep checking the website, because we will keep track of the big music business stories. Although, in terms of the daily and in terms of the podcast, we're back in January. Have a great Christmas, New Year, Hogmanay, etc.
Yes, that's right. Yes, follow us at CMU on Twitter. You will receive our important news updates in your feed. So definitely follow us there. Subscribe to the podcast. You could we're off, you could go back and listen to the archive of podcasts, which is all there.
But not all the way back to 2010.
No,
because remember
we don't talk about
the old ones.
But once you've listened to everything we've recorded since. When did we come back? July? June?
Yeah, July.
July. You can listen to all of those, and then you can write a really informed review on iTunes.
I think. Or just give us a 5-star rating.
Just give us a 5-star rating. But I think the festive break gives people time to really think about what is great about this podcast and put it in words in an iTunes review.
Concise endings will not be in any of those
reviews. No.
Hey, do the bit you do right at the end.
This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. If you want more from CMU, go to Complete Music Update and have yourself a happy Christmas and New Year.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
This week, a miracle streaming royalties.
A miracle?
Miracle.
I like that. I'm going to start using that.